Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 15th.
16th.
Today is the 16th of March, yes. Representative Isaacson moves approval of the minutes dated March 3rd. Any discussion?
With all my meaning, yes.
Yeah. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members and guests, we have a new member of our team here. Jonathan Fortner is left, and Megan Rice is the new committee legislative assistant. Megan comes to us from Stillwater State Prison as part of the work release program. And Ms. Rice, perhaps you could introduce yourself and tell us if you could be any animal, what you would be and why.
Run away.
We all had to do this, Megan.
No, we didn't.
Probably a dog, because you can sleep all day and, you know, get treats and stuff.
All right. So that's great work ethic in our new CLA there, bringing them up, you know, sleep all day. That's awesome. Now, welcome to the committee. She's doing a great job. Just started a little second week, so lots going on. So, all right. So the first, Representative Hortman, you had a couple questions before we got started. And I just want to, for members, obviously, with the floor session going along, we're going to have to move things along today. My preference would be not to come back this evening. I'd like to wrap this up today. So just give our questions, and especially for the testifiers, please be brief. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, as we start off our first official meeting of the session, if you could give us a kind of a roadmap of how you intend to move bills. Last year at the end of the session, people might remember we had sort of an interesting time on the floor where the bill, it came out of conference committee, members didn't have an opportunity to read it before the vote, and then that was one of many reasons we ended up in special session. And I think we sort of make decisions here in this committee, starting at this particular time, about whether we're going to do things in a way that lead us towards a train wreck or that lead us away from a train wreck. And, you know, one of my questions is whether you intend to blend policy and budget issues together, whether you intend to blend job development, energy, and housing issues together. And the concern I would like to articulate at this early point as we get started, that we could send valuable job development proposals together in an economic development bill and not hold them hostage with energy policy that wouldn't be bipartisan. And so I'm just in the interest of avoiding a train wreck this session, because unfortunately the difference between this session and last session is no bills have to get signed. We could leave here today with no bills being enacted into law. The state would continue to operate on the budget that we put into place in 2015, and that was signed by the governor. So just if you could outline with the bills today what's being held over for possible inclusion, and for possible inclusion in what? One big garbage bill or three separate subject matter bills, or what are your plans?
Thank you. Representative Hortman, as has been the practice with other finance committees, my expectation would be that financial policy and appropriations will go together. I think there's situations where individual policy and individual appropriations bills may go by themselves. I would point out to the fact that this committee has already acted on a single bill before the session started that went by itself. But right now, I think you can plan on most items being held over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Beyond that, I can't tell you what the structure is, if there's going to be. Historically, I think in 2014, there was an omnibus supplemental finance and policy bill. I don't know if that's going to take place, or if the individual finance committees are going to pass their own articles and hear those individually on the floor. I just don't know the answer to that question, Representative Orvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, it sounds like your intention then is to blend policy and budget issues together in one bill.
Representative Hortman, financial policy, and appropriations. That won't be the only bill we do, but certainly you can plan on that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to note, as we move some of these bills for possible inclusion in a later bill, that when we do that, knowing in advance that what we're doing is mixing economic development, which we can all agree on, with energy policy, which we can't all agree on, and our governor's already indicated a willingness to veto certain provisions, that we are, in fact, dooming the economic development provisions that we all agree on by putting them in the same vehicle.
Well, Representative Hartman, I'm an optimist, and I don't think it's a little bit too early for doom and gloom. So I don't see that happening. And at the end of the day, the only way a bill becomes law is if a Republican-controlled House and a DFL-controlled Senate and a DFL governor agree on that provision. So that's the only way things are going to happen. The process by which we get there is more inside baseball. But Representative Hartman.
In closing, Mr. Chair, I just feel, as a member of this committee, that since our product contributed to our D-minus in 2015, that we undertake efforts to get Minnesota in a position to get a better grade on transparency in 2016.
Now, Representative Hartman, you're always an A in my book. So with that, Representative Peterson, you have the first bill in the committee today. The chair will move House File 2514. We recommended to pass and referred to the general register. And Representative Peterson, as well as the testifiers, were under an extreme time frame, so I would say less is more. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo and members, and that is exactly how I instructed my testifiers. Before you is a bill that is a host community economic development grants. The cities of Burnsville and Embergrove Heights do have former landfills in there, and the host community grant system is basically to compensate for that loss in revenue that was collected while basically we were accepting everyone's garbage. So this is offering a little bit more flexibility. And then I'm going to just move along to our testifiers. They can introduce their names and sure. Speak to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the cities of Invergrove Heights and Burnsville. The bill that's before you basically makes some clarifications to the law that was adopted in 2013 that will make it easier for the cities to make their applications to deed by changing or correcting some definitions, and it will make it more efficient for deed to administer the program. The biggest issue that we have is making sure that long-term economic development programs are eligible in this development program that was adopted, and that is the bulk of the change. I'd be happy to answer any questions about why the language is here. We've worked with DEED on this language. I'm not aware of any opposition. Thank you.
And do either of the mayors wish to testify?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. Mayor of Invergrove Heights, George Torville. And again, we'll be brief. And I love dogs also. So we our landfill, again, is continuing to operate and will operate for at least the next 7 to 12 years with space availability. We're looking for your support in the continuance of the funding that comes through DEED. We work with DEED on a lot of projects. We work with DEED very closely on this project. And I take a look at the criteria. And our first project was a piece of property that was polluted and needed correction, and we used some of the funding in order to bring that. It's not yet, because we need to do some more work, but we're bringing that piece of property on the rolls, which will hopefully be developed. It will take a look at job creation, an increase in tax base, and the project to attract some private investment, and hopefully the long-term economic development. And we really depend on the money. We took a hit with the changes. We want to try to stay whole, and we want to continue to work with the committee and also with DEED in order to allow that to happen. And again, after we both speak, if there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Couts. I'm the mayor of the city of Burnsville. It's great to be before you, and we all care about economic development. And so we ask you to please continue your support on this particular bill. And we're happy to always come before you every 2 years, according to statute, to be accountable and transparent. We're okay with that. One of the things we do in local government is to make sure that we bring businesses, and we are in partnership with Greater MSP and other organizations to help bring business into our communities to help spur jobs and the tax base. So we're asking for your support. We want to make sure that we have the tools in our toolbox for economic development. We have very little tools to work with. But this one allows communities like Burnsville and Invergrove Heights that are challenged because we continue to operate active landfills to work through all of this. We're also great stewards of the environment. We care about our environment, and we care about sustainability. And so the challenge is we're not getting the funds that we thought we would get by being host to garbage, but we would like your support, continued support, and partnership in making sure that our metropolitan area and our state continues to thrive and be a great economic engine to create jobs for our people. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member questions or comments. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson. Your bill does a lot, and it truly does move away from where this bill was originally crafted and designed to do. The host committee, host community economic development, was designed to clean up the landfill and do economic development around the landfill. What this bill does is allow you to do economic development anywhere in Burnsville, anywhere in Amber Grove Heights. Entirely changes the and completely changes the nature of the bill here, nature of this particular program, and does not necessarily require everyone else's money that's being paid to your community to be used to clean up the landfill. So it does completely change what the original intent of this particular bill was. It's not a question, that's just a comment.
Representative Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where was the motion to send the bill?
General Register.
Mr. Chair, since it entails the expenditure of more than $5,000, it has to go to Ways and Means.
Yes, I believe.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is $375,000.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, this does nothing with the money relative to the fund. The funds has already been appropriated and is in place. This merely changes the grant application and approval process. It does nothing with that. And Representative Mahoney, I've represented the cities. I just want to briefly touch on your comments because I agree. I agree, but I just want you to know when I first talked with the city, the issue was the loss of their host community fees. Yes. And that was the biggest problem that they had. Mm-hmm. And that money can be used for any kind of purpose around the city. And that was part of the hole in their budget that we were trying to address. So I do understand the need to develop around the landfill, but I think I've been involved with this from the onset, and I can tell you that was always part of our request, is to somehow backfill the funds they're losing because we have increased recycling, we have increased waste processing, all good things, but that has had an economic impact on the city. So there were two components to it. I just want to make sure that we don't forget about that.
Ms. Hendricks, is the chair right that there's no fiscal note, or is everybody else wrong? No one caught that, really? Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's no fiscal impact from this bill. This program is funded through the general fund, but this bill doesn't change any of those appropriations.
Seeing no additional comments, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2514 recommended to pass and refer to the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See you on the floor, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Tice.
Can we get to the
Representative Gunther moves that House File 2887 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Tice, to your bill.
We've all done it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2887 is a bill that provides extra funding for the independent life centers across Minnesota. As you can tell from the handout that you have in your packet, the independent living centers provide services across our state and are critical to providing care for people who wish to stay independent. As many members of this committee know, the state spends a lot of money when it comes to the permanent and long-term care. The independent living centers help bridge the gap for our clients to keep Minnesotans in their homes, employed, and with job skills. This saves our state budget money and provides a win-win for our constituents. Last year, it seemed there was a consensus to have some extra funding provided for the independent living centers, but when all was finished with the 2015 session, the center's budgets were frozen. A bipartisan group of lawmakers from both bodies have come forward to ask us to rectify some of the smaller but very important budget priorities that were somehow left behind in the last session. I'd like to thank members of this committee for your strong support in the past, and I hope that you continue that support this year. With me today are four individuals who can testify to the importance of the services provided by the centers from both a staff and client perspective, and I would like to start by introducing Kara Ruff, Director of Independent Lifestyles in Sauk Rapids. This center provides services in central Minnesota, including some of the folks in my district. She will visit with you regarding what the centers do and how the new money will be utilized.
Welcome
thank you.
Committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Kara Ruff, and I am the Executive Director of Independent Lifestyles and the Vice President for the Minnesota Association of Centers for Independent Living, which is the umbrella for the eight Centers for Independent Living in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for allowing us to be here today. We appreciate the opportunity. As Representative Tice stated, in the packet you have our fact sheet, which does state that we are seeking $1 million in additional state support to be added to the base funding for all centers for independent living in Minnesota. Our goal is to achieve $1.2 million in combined state and federal dollars, with the ultimate goal of $18.5 million to fully serve Minnesotans across the state. As you can see on the map in the packet, we have very large service areas to fulfill, and we don't currently have the resources to do that. Many centers, including mine, have waiting lists for services. The dollars that we're asking for would be spent for additional staff, their benefits, and transportation across the state of Minnesota, so that we can begin to fully and adequately serve people with disabilities across the state. One of the reasons I've chosen to spend my entire career in Centers for Independent Living is because I always wanted to help people, but when you get into the system, you often realize that the system is preventing that in itself with the bureaucracies involved. And Centers for Independent Living are community-based and consumer-controlled. We are unique than other service providers, which means 51% of our staff and board must be people with disabilities so that we're truly governed by those that we serve. We provide services in people's homes and in the communities in which they live. We provide services to across disability populations, so anyone with any type of disability, physical, cognitive, mental, emotional, chemical, sensory, any type of disability is qualified for services just based on that. They don't have to have a certain IQ or income level. They simply have to have any type of or level of disability. We are non-residential, based locally, and we also serve birth to death. So we are really the disability one-stop shop in our communities across the state. We provide a wide range of supports and services, including independent living skills training, which often helps individuals become employed. If they do not are not able to acquire independent living skills, they often are not able to achieve and maintain employment, and we've worked really closely with vocational rehabilitation and DEED on those services. We provide accessibility, advocacy, peer mentoring, information and referral, and a whole wide variety of other services. Representative Tice mentioned our cost savings. I think this is one of the smartest investments that the legislature can make in people with disabilities in Minnesota. One small part of our services include relocating people from nursing homes and institutions. In the past year, we assisted 67 people from getting out of nursing homes or institutions, and which created a cost savings of $3.143 million. Just in that, and if we took into consideration the other 458 individuals that were served that were prevented from having to go into a nursing home or higher cost out-of-home placement, the savings would be around $12.4 million. Just a staggering number in comparison to how we're currently funded. Representative Gunther has always been a long-term supporter of ours, and one of the things that I've admired most about him is that not only what he says, but his actions follow that he believes in people first, in serving people first. And while this committee has many important issues before it, I implore you to put people with disabilities first in Minnesota and make some corrections to the terrible travesty that is happening across the state and fund services that are cost-effective, efficient, and outcome-based. and most importantly, allow people with disabilities to live with dignity and with choice. I would like to invite Gloria up here to testify with us now.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for letting me have this opportunity to testify. My name is Gloria Lafreniere. I'm from White Earth, Minnesota, White Earth Indian Reservation, living in Bagley, Minnesota. I am the director of White Earth Vocational Rehab, which is it's very similar to the state vocational rehab. There are two in Minnesota, one on White Earth and one in Red Lake. Just quickly, I know we're under time here. Our goals, of course, are the same as vocational rehab, to insist. Ours are a little different. Enrolled members with disabilities living on or near our reservation to obtain, engage, and gainful employment, secondary education, or entrepreneurship. That is well and good in itself, but we can not begin to serve everyone. However, every single referral to White Earth with disabilities comes to our office. If they are not eligible for services, or if they cannot work or go to school, still have a disability, we need to know all our other resources. And throughout the years, Options Independent Living is our most valuable resource that we have, and we can attest to the benefit and the success of our program today. There's many issues that come with disability if they cannot work and not be eligible for our program. Homelessness, the veterans issues, descendants. We cannot serve descendants. They must be enrolled members. I can sincerely say I attribute any success to our program with our partners. We work with them at least on a weekly basis, I would say sometimes three or four times a week, for their advice and their expertise. Our reservation members and descendants are always comfortable with Options, and we also are person-centered, client-centered in what they want. And also, the goals are to live as independently as we can in our own homes, in our own communities. We should not have to come to relocate for different services. Just quickly, I'll try to move on. Without our collaborative partners, services to our members would be highly diminished, and I can't emphasize that as much. There would be much more hopelessness, and our economy would be continue to go down. Just a few bullets that I'll give that we work with. Assistive technology. Many of our folks are on a waiting period. For instance, they do have access to healthcare, Indian health services. For example, our elders with cataracts, you're in a waiting list. You do not. That's considered an elective surgery. Options came in a while back and helped one of our veterans with the opportunity to come down to the cities here and get his surgery. Otherwise, he would have been sleeping in his car. We also have a Disability Awareness Day. They come over and do our training to our tribal councils, to our tribal entities, to our human resource departments. And they are more friendly now to disability issues. Another issue we had was with service animals. The landlords did not want to let service animals come into their apartments. Gave one call to Options. They were over. The matter was cleared up within probably 2 days. We give office space and collaborative partners to another one of their employees to help us with the IEPs in the high schools. That's another service. We only have four staff now, and we serve 1,200 square miles up there in White Earth Reservation. They also help with the different issues that we have with their felons getting out of prison with disabilities for housing, for employment-related issues. Quickly, just to end, I want to thank you again. Y'all know rural communities, our hardships are a little harder in many areas, such as lack of housing, transportation, and health care. These are the issues that I'll call Options on weekly, if not sometimes daily, and I know that I'm going to get the help and support and the right resources to refer our clients who are not eligible for us. Our clients are people with disabilities. We do not ask for special treatment. We all just want a level playing field. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And members, I want to point out in your packets you'll have written testimony. One of the supporters of this preferred to offer written testimony, so to speak, so make sure to do that in your packets. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, My name is TJ Roberts. And I'd like to thank you for letting me share my experience with you. I live in Rochester, Minnesota. I currently live in a group home. I have used stem cell services for a variety of things over the last year. Stem cell worked with me to better advocate for myself and what I want and increase my independence. Stem cell has taught me how to self-advocate. I feel this is important because only you truly know what is best for you. Stem cell helped me to self-advocate for myself, and when I was not being heard at my group home, I contacted Stem cell, and they helped me to better advocate for myself and move on with my goals. Stem cell has helped me to better understand my work incentives and why I should strive to work. I am currently working at Trader Joe's. I love that place. I feel it is important because in order to live on my own and get off benefits, eventually, I would need to make enough money to support myself. Stem cell has assisted me in completing an IL assessment. An IL assessment helps identify what I know and what I need to know. This assessment led to empowering me to advocate for myself in independent living situations. I will be moving out of my group home and into an apartment with support on April 1st. I feel the IL assessment is a great thing to offer others and has truly moved me forward in my road to independence. Stem cell has assisted me in obtaining my driver's permit. I am working on getting my license, which will allow me to get more hours at my job and hopefully work off benefits. With the help of Stem cell and their services, I have achieved a greater independence, and when I graduate from my 18 to 21 year old program next year, I believe I'll be prepared for the real world. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, and thanks for making the visit to testify. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Corporal Schneider. I'm a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. I'm here today to tell you a little bit about my homeless experience. Since coming out of the military, my transition has not been an easy one. I've been diagnosed with epilepsy and PTSD, which has stopped my ability to work and earn an income. So I had to live a year of my life in a hunting blind. First, to live on the streets is not an easy one, not knowing where my next meal was coming from, forcing myself to adapt to the situation. It's hard to imagine the struggle that others are facing today. One thing that I've learned was that red squirrels taste a lot better than gray squirrels. Reality only hits us, unfortunately, when you're at your rock bottom, and mine did, standing in line with an empty stomach and frostbitten toes. That's when I got the idea in my head that when I do get out of this situation, I'm going to do my best to help. Looking around and seeing the faces of these adults and children saddens me to know that even myself has looked away when others ask for help. We've all been guilty of it, even myself, for turning my head when the problem is right in front of me. These people that we turn away from do not have a lot of opportunities, and I can say that from experience. I've tried these other opportunities, the county, the veterans, and one place that has worked for me has been Access North. One day I received a phone call from a man named Steve Bachholm. My first idea was that it was just another line to stand in and another door closed in my face. Walking through the doors at Access North, I was unsure. Now, from living on a hunting blind to sitting here in this chair today, I have only Access North to thank for that. And the people at Access North have gone beyond and out of their way to help me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions or comments. Oh, Representative Smzynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the testifiers for your sharing your personal stories. I appreciate that. Just kind of a, just a general question on the kind of the funding levels and kind of talking about service areas. And, you know, under current funding levels, would you say that there are any gaps in the outreach that you're able to do, you know, and how this would potentially affect that? And if you could fill us in on some of that.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we have significant gaps right now. We've been struggling, and as you can see from the funding chart, we're currently still below where we were funded in 2008. So this has been a long, hard struggle for us. And as you can see on the map, we have between 9 and 11 counties per CIL to fulfill, and that is a tremendous area to fill. And so we can't adequately serve all of those counties and areas, and it gets really tough as they spoke in the more rural areas where there is no transportation, there are no resources at all. If we don't get out there, people stay stuck in hunting blinds and in nursing homes and living with unhealthy family members sometimes. You know, it's really critical that we are able to get out there and get these services. I don't think there's anything worse than being stuck in a nursing home or out of home placement against your will, other than having to be the one to tell them, we can't serve you, we don't have the resources.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rupp, just briefly, how do you get most of your clients, and is it from nursing homes or county social services? What's the source,
Ms. Rupp,
typically?
Mr. Chair, members, our referrals come from all sources, county social services, other disability organizations, the schools, Social Security Administration. Oftentimes, nursing homes aren't the ones to call us because they don't want us to free their people. So we are usually going in there by the request of the consumer or the family member. And so it's really critical. But that's the great thing. There is not a lot of bureaucracy and red tape. If somebody comes into any of the 8 centers and says, I have a disability, I need help with housing or transportation or benefits or financial management or cooking or nutrition or whatever it might be, we can assist them with any of that.
And on behalf of the committee, let me say thank you to each of our testifiers, and Corporal Schneider, thank you for your service to our nation. We all appreciate it. With that, Representative Gunther, you have a comment.
I'd just like to make one comment. You know, when Governor Plenty was governor, he canceled funding for the SILS. And I went to talk to him, and he didn't realize that it was canceled. And we talked about it, and he finally was convinced that SIL does not cost money. It saves the state money. Without the ability for SILs to train people to live on their own, institutionalization is very, very high. And I think at the time he called and told me it was $8 million. So that's pretty good to save money, and you don't see that very often here.
With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 2887 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so we have two bills left, members. What we're going to do is we're going to take up the Baker bill, and it's going to be my intent to finish that by, I want to give Representative Moran at least 10, if not 15 minutes for her bill at the end of the committee. So, Representative Baker, if you could advise your testifiers to be brief, we'll proceed from there.
Sure will.
Representative Baker moves House File 2486 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Baker, to your bill and to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, because our time is limited here, I did want to just give a quick overview of why I brought this bill to our committee today. Prior to being in the legislature, I was served on...
Representative Baker, the DE-2 amendment is the author's amendment. So
thank you. Yes,
Baker moves the DE-2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative Baker to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, I'm Wilmer Municipal Utilities for about 6 or 7 years back in Wilmer prior to me being here in St. Paul for a part-time job. I learned a lot about how things work, how SIP works, and how good of a program SIP actually is and was. And over the years, I have seen our utility in Wilmer struggle more and more each year with what is left for us to save. And I think there's a real tipping point. We're at a moment in time for the smallest utilities in our rural communities to find the best, most affordable way to exercise their ability to deliver affordable and reliable energy to their customers. So in rural Minnesota, this bill talks about our smallest companies, our smallest utility companies, which are the munis and the co-ops. So with me today is a couple of folks that will testify on what's happening. This all started with my conversation with our general manager in Wilmer, which is Wes Hopp, who will be testifying shortly about their concerns of where the SIP program is today, where it started, and sort of the history there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn over some of the testifiers, and I'll be ready to answer questions later on.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'll tee it up. Bill Black from Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I'll try to give I'll try to be brief, but I'll especially try to be fast and tell you what the bill does and why it's being brought forward. House File 2486 would do two things. First, current law allows the Department of Commerce, upon its discretion, to modify the energy savings goal of a utility for any of the following reasons: the utility's historical conservation investment experience, its particular combination of residential, commercial, and industrial customers, growth in the amount of energy required by its customers, the results of a conservation potential study, or other factors that warrant adjustment as determined by the department. This would stay the same under this bill for the investor-owned utilities, Xcel, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail, but when a consumer-owned municipal or cooperative utility requests a goal modification for those same reasons or other reasons put forward by the utility, that request would be deemed approved automatically. Second, current law allows utilities to count energy savings toward their goals from improvements to their utility systems only after they attain 1% annual savings on their customers' properties from things like light bulb replacements and appliance rebates. The change proposed in this bill would allow utility system energy efficiency improvements by municipal and cooperative utilities to count toward their energy savings goals regardless of whether they make it to the 1% in customer site energy savings. The reasons for these changes are to fix two inherent problems in the SIP program created by major changes to the law in 2007 when the legislature determined that going forward indefinitely, utilities would not only have to spend 1.5% of their annual revenues on conservation and efficiency improvements, they would also have to document the energy savings that occur in the first year in which they spend that money. This is known as the energy savings goal, and for every utility, it was set in 2007 at 1.5%. unless modified by individual utilities by the Department of Commerce. The adaptability built into the law in 2007 to modify the individual goals should make it a more sustainable program where over time utilities' goals are adjusted to reflect the reality of the energy savings potential of their differing systems. However, the department has not been adjusting those goals, and I believe the problem lies not with the department but with the statute itself. The statute asks the department to do something it can't possibly handle: to make determinations about what the appropriate energy savings potential is for up to 172 electric utilities and 8 natural gas utilities that could potentially warrant a goal adjustment, and to do so year after year after year. I don't wonder why the department doesn't approve utility conservation plans that forecast energy savings potential for less than 1.5%, because how would the people at the department know what's going on in Candy, Ohio, or Alvarado, Jackson, Mountain Iron, Buffalo, Duluth, Madison, and Le Sueur? How could they weigh all the factors that go into the determinations made by those cities, electric or gas utilities, in developing their annual conservation plans and say whether that's accurate? For investor-owned utilities, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission scrutinizes their conservation plans because it has to verify that the IOUs deserve to recover incentive costs for their programs from their ratepayers. It can't possibly do that for the 174 consumer-owned utilities, nor should it. They have their own governing commissions, councils, or boards, and they're owned by their customers. So that is the overarching reason for this bill: to fix a large flaw in the SIP statute that results in all utilities being treated the same, from Xcel Energy to the City of Neillsville's electric department and its 50 customers run by the city clerk. The reasons why we should fix this problem are important. It's not enough to say, well, there's no penalty for not complying, so let's just leave it. It's true that there's no enforcement provision in the SIP statute, but setting unattainable goals in law for real hardworking people not to meet year after year after year has negative consequences felt by real people. The short answer is that that's just bad public policy, but a fuller answer comes from a look at what levels of energy savings the various municipal utilities have managed and not managed to achieve and why. Municipal utilities started reporting their energy savings to the state beginning with savings that occurred in 2011, and at the same time they started submitting plans for the coming year. We now have the reported energy savings from 2011, 12, 13, and 14, and the plans for 2012, 13, and 14. They're publicly available online. There are 125 municipal electric utilities in Minnesota. For 27 of them, it has not been cost-effective for them even to make it to the starting gate, and they have not reported any spending or savings. For some, their annual revenues are so low that it would take 1.5% of them over multiple years just to hire a consultant to tell them what they already know, that they don't have either the staffing or the scale and customer base to take on an efficiency program or to make cost-effective investments. 93 municipal electric utilities reported to the state in 2011. Over 2012, 13, and 14, the number leveled off at 98, 99, and 100 municipal utilities reporting. Two-thirds of those found enough spending opportunities that, by varying definitions, could be called cost-effective to meet the 1.5% spending requirement. And from all 4 years of data, only 30 to 40% of the 100 or so municipal utilities reporting were able to document 1.5% in utility cost energy savings. The reasons why many municipal utilities are not making it really vary a great deal. The people here today can tell you about some of them. And I know how tempting it is to try to come up with specific solutions here in this room and try to fix the law in this place or that. In fact, we tried to find a common enough thread among a room full of people like Wes and Wendy and Brian here from North St. Paul Utility, who are the ones trying to make SIP work at their utilities, when we convened a summit of municipal conservation and efficiency personnel at MMUA in November last year. What we found is that making the program more prescriptive to account for every issue simply is not a tenable solution. There is one place in the law to make a targeted improvement, and that would be to count utility system improvements that save energy, as this bill would allow. As the law is now, those improvements aren't happening in places, because by the time a utility reaches the minimum 1% customer savings goal, it's too late in the year to undertake a system improvement like transformer or line replacements, capacitor upgrades, and other projects. Those would be real energy savings and would help some municipal utilities reach their goal. Wrapping up, we all knew in 2007 that in a few years the legislature would probably need to look again at the SIP law and see what might need adjusting, mainly because no one knew what a 1.5% energy savings goal, how it was going to work out. At the time, the term low-hanging fruit became one of the most hated terms heard around the Capitol. It referred to energy savings measures that could be instituted cost-effectively. Some said it would be many years before all that fruit was picked. But the results show the range of variation among utilities and the fact that many, and I do mean many, have little fruit to pick because they just don't have the trees. I've personally heard often from MMUA's members that people at the Department of Commerce who administer the Conservation Improvement Program show a cooperative spirit that you don't normally see from a government agency. It's one of those rare government programs where the people at the agency take a partnering approach to help the regulated entities as best they can. But I believe their hands are tied by the problems with the law that this bill would help to alleviate. Since we can see now from the data just how ill-fitting this one-size-fits-all goal truly is for municipal utilities, I ask that you update the policy by making it fair, making it better public policy, and making it account for the vast differences among utilities the way it was intended to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Did you want to, or did either our testifiers want to provide additional testimony? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wesley Hump. I'm the general manager of Wilmer Municipal Utilities. I've been the general manager for past 4 years when Representative Baker hired me at that time as the head of the utilities. Prior to that, I was 22 years as electrical engineer for the utility. I've been a licensed professional engineer since 1989. As electrical engineer for the utilities, I've always been interested in and promoted the efficient use of electricity. In 99, we hired a full-time permanent employee to be our energy services representative to help us with the goals of incentivizing energy efficiency for our customers, who are also our owners. Because we are owned by those we serve, any costs we incur go towards what the rates we charge to our customer owners. And we have a very real incentive to keep our rates as competitive as possible, so we look for programs that would benefit both the utility and the customer. We then set to work implementing the programs, such as Energy Star appliances, compact fluorescent lights, variable speed motor drives, commercial lighting retrofits, and other programs. We talked energy efficiency to anyone and everyone who would listen to us, service clubs, church organizations, schools, private organizations. And we partnered with other organizations like Clean Energy Resource Team, the CERTS. We worked with those people quite a bit because what we found out is a lot of people wanted to generate megawatts that were clean. But we needed to make sure that they understood that the cleanest megawatt there is called the negawatt, the one that's never made, because you have energy efficiency. We continued to preach efficiency every chance we got and found that if you put out a truthful message like this often enough, it would get through. Energy efficiency is now a normal part of Wilmerite's conversation, and when discussing any electrical energy use device, that's part of what they make their decision on, because they know that the real cost of an electrical appliance is not the purchase price, but what you pay us in the long run. In short, we did the math for them. Until now, they got the math. They understand it. In addition to the required reduction in kilowatt hours on top of our mandated utility expenses for the 1.5% of the gross receipts, we realized in 2007 that we were a victim of our own success. As Bill had mentioned, the low-hanging fruit had not only been picked, but they went up with the ladder and picked a lot of the rest of the fruit. So by the time we got to this required kilowatt-hour savings, there weren't a whole lot of pieces left to do. We did our best. Our full-time energy services person struggled with this mandate, and he worked very hard and very diligently, doubled his efforts to get more and more energy savings for our customers. And he did a very good job, but we never, ever were able to make that 1.5%, no matter how much money we threw into this. And again, we're trying to do cost-effective measures, not just throwing money wantonly to see if we can save energies to meet the goal. And what happened, honestly, is that by putting all that money into these refunds, our customers did see some real benefits off of there, but we ran out of customers to give the rebates to. And even though he worked very diligently at it, our energy services person was getting frustrated to the point where he decided instead of spending two more years to full retirement, he was going to retire early because he hated going to work to fulfill goals that he knew he could never get to. And we ask that you take a consideration to this bill and help us drive our energy savings, because we can do it. We just need to make sure that we have goals that are realistic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Wendy Meyer. I'm the city administrator of the city of Mountain Lake. As with any small cities, I wear a lot of hats, and today I'm here as the utility manager, and I'm testifying in support of House File 2486. Mountain Lake is a member of the Central Minnesota Power Agency and Services Compass. I'll be referring to them again later. We have a population of about 2,200 people, with 820 residential customers, 39 rural customers, 165 commercial, and 11 large commercial industrial customers. Our community is stable and growing slightly, and in southwest Minnesota, that's a good thing. That's very positive. And so when the Conservation Improvement Plan began back in 2002, 2003, the staff at that time went out and heavily promoted the program. Made contact with all of our commercial industrial customers, advertisement and utility flyers in the newspaper. We embraced the program and dug right in. We had a good working relationship. Everybody in town knew where to get their refrigerator rebates and all those sorts of things. Looking back at it, staff feels that we, as Wes just mentioned, picked the low-hanging fruit. When the program changed beginning in 2011, it was difficult. It became difficult for us to meet that savings goal. And if you take a look at the spreadsheet that was distributed, you can see that. We're either way under or way over. And so any opportunity for us to plan for improvements in our system when we reach the 1% just has not been there. Our advertising costs, the way we promote the program, doesn't vary much from year to year. We continue to have about the same number of rebates as we track those things. It just comes down to our limited our limited ability because we have so few commercial industrial customers. In the years we have matched the goals, it's mostly because we've had our large manufacturers, which, and I'm talking now about 60 jobs, and a large manufacturer did some motor replacements. In the years that we didn't meet our goal, it's mostly because those industrial commercial customers did not do projects. And so our success or failure depends upon that small group of which we have really no control. Well, we did meet our goal last year. We saw that mostly because of LED and lighting with both our commercial and our residential. That was a good thing, but you don't replace an LED light bulb every year, so we know that that's a limited source of progress as well. So I would encourage you to consider House File 2486 and the changes it brings, because it would certainly make my job at Mountain Lake a little easier. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to member questions and comments, I do want to see if there's any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill. Mr. Grant? Anyone else? Raise your hand if you're going to be testifying, just so I know. Okay. You may. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is anybody moving the A7 amendment?
Is anyone going to be moving the A7 amendment? Doesn't look like it, Representative Hartman.
Okay, so then we won't ask questions about that.
Nope.
That would be wise. We got, sure, Representative Isaacson.
It's actually just a question maybe for House Research. My understanding was 1.5% was a goal, not a mandate. I heard it was referred to as a mandate. I want to make sure that I'm not missing something. Is the 1.5% a mandate or a goal?
Mr. Elon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Isaacson, it's referred to in statute as a goal, but I think as Mr. Black mentioned, there is no penalty for not achieving the goal.
Representative Isaacson.
So that would mean that it's not a mandate then?
Mr. Elon.
It's a mandate in that all utilities are by statute supposed to achieve it, but there is no penalty for not achieving it. I'm not sure exactly how that ends up being described accurately.
I certainly won't make you explain how that could happen. Thank you.
Mr. Grant, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. I wanted to start by briefly acquainting you with some statistics from a recent study, independent study that we had done on the Conservation Improvement Program, which found that over the years that this has been in place, we've saved over $2.6 billion in utility bill savings for Minnesota residents and businesses. In 2014, there were over 9,600 jobs in Minnesota dedicated to energy efficiency, a 50% increase since the year 2000. We save enough electricity and natural gas every year to power 112,000 homes in the state. Efficiency has been and continues to be our least cost resource, averaging about a penny and a half a kilowatt hour. Compare that to the average price of a new source of supply, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 cents per kilowatt hour. And our municipal and electric cooperative utilities together, taken as a group, have been achieving the goal, continue to achieve the goal. In 2013, for example, municipal and cooperative utilities saved 1.7% as a group on the natural gas side. And we haven't talked about natural gas utilities, but this bill does affect them as well. Municipal gas utilities have saved about 0.7% against a goal of 1%. As Mr. Black kindly pointed out, the department has, I think, a good track record in working with all utilities on the Conservation Improvement Program. As the question to Mr. Eliff just noted, there are no penalties for failing to achieve goals. Programs have to be cost effective. But as I read, particularly, Mr. Chairman, lines 2.3 through 2.6 of the delete all, both municipal and cooperative utilities, regardless of their size, can propose a zero goal, and the department would be required to approve that goal. You know, this just replaces one size fits all solution with another in an instance when the problem, I think, to the extent there is one, is much more limited in scope and limited to the very smallest utilities that we have in our state. So far, the department has had only one request to change a goal, and we were able in that instance to work with the local utility to help it begin achieving its goal. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, the department has strong concerns with House File 2486 and would recommend that it not move forward.
Mr. Grant, can you comment on paragraphs E and F of the bill, of the delete all?
Mr. Chairman, you're referring to existing language?
The delete all amendment, the paragraphs E and F, can you comment on the department's position on those two paragraphs? In the Baker delete all amendment, the DE2?
Okay, line 2.1. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm not.
Sure, 2.4 through 2.18. This is the energy electric utility infrastructure projects and the way they're currently treated in law versus what the bill would do. Can you comment on the department's position on
that? Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we haven't taken a formal position on this, but I do believe that this is a step in the right direction. We do need some clarity around the role of electric utility infrastructure projects within SIP. We think it holds a lot of promise to assist utilities that have mined a lot of their demand-side efficiency by also encouraging supply-side efficiency. So, Mr. Chairman, while we don't have a formal position on that portion of the bill, I do believe it's a step in the right direction.
Mr. Grant, will the department be offering any suggested language in addressing some of Mr. Black's concerns that he brought forward or Representative Baker has mentioned? There seem like reasonable concerns. Is there anything that will be proposed by the department this year?
Mr. Chairman and members, be happy to work with Representative Baker as the bill moves forward.
We had an additional testifier, and then we'll go to members' questions. I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please thank you, Mr. Grant, for being here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Will Nissen. I'm a senior policy associate at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is an independent, nonprofit energy policy advocacy group located here in Minnesota. We have long supported and continue to support the 1.5% energy savings goal. We believe it is a useful benchmark for utilities as they develop and implement their plans. And as we've seen and as you've heard, many utilities both meet and exceed that goal to the point where as a state, we are close to, if not achieving higher than that 1.5% goal. However, we do acknowledge and appreciate the fact that each utility is unique, has a different customer base, different customer size, different resources available. So we are committed to working with utilities, with Representative Baker, to find ways to expand our conservation improvement programs so we ensure that we continue capturing energy savings in our state. So while we can't support the language as written because we are committed to the 1.5% goal, we do look forward to working with all utilities moving forward to see how we can ensure energy savings in our state.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Same questions I asked Mr. Grant, specifically paragraph E and F. Can you comment on that? Does Fresh Energy have a position on that language?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, similar to Mr. Grant, we support the expanded use of some utility electric utility infrastructure projects as they can and have been shown here and in other states to save energy. We sponsored a bill last year that would expand the use of electric utility infrastructure projects. Our concern would remain that those types of projects not eat into existing demand-side efficiency potential. So that those types of projects not hinder or prevent demand-side efficiency that actually saves customers money directly on their bills.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Mike, I didn't see you there. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Cole. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment. We're a 35-year-old nonprofit in Minneapolis, and we
deliver energy efficiency programs as well as work on energy efficiency policy for the state. We would like to echo the comments of everyone that just testified to you. I think this is a really good conversation. The energy efficiency goals that we have, you know, they have done tremendous benefit for the state over the years. Started the current 1.5% 1 to 1.5% efficiency goals that we have that went in place in 2007 were just the latest incarnation of goals that have gone back for decades. So we've been working in the state for decades to provide energy efficiency benefits to your constituencies and businesses and the electrical contractors who are doing the great work and delivering great benefits to the state as a whole. I think it is useful to take another look at some aspects of the Conservation Improvement Program, and I would echo the comments of Deputy Commissioner Grant that we should look at that at the paragraphs E and F, and I think that there's opportunities there, and we will we have met with the munis and the co-ops, and we will continue that conversation. We appreciate Representative Baker's leadership on this. I didn't realize that he had served on the municipal utility there. It's one of the innovative municipal. They're all great utilities, but Wilmer in particular has done a great job over the years, partnering where it can with the local co-op, which is not all that common, we'll just say. And I think it's great to see his leadership continuing on that topic.
Make Wilmer great again. Thank you for your testimony. First of all, before we, are there any other members of the public who should testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? No. Okay, with that, we'll close public comment and we'll move to member questions. Representative Hortman, you had a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would echo the comments that were just made. I would like to work with Representative Baker on this proposal to get it to something that I could support. I think the problem that you've identified is we have a one size fits all law, and we have little munis like Alpha with 196 customers or something, and what you're proposing is a solution that's the same for 90 people or 90,000 people or 900,000 people, and I think we're just solving one problem by creating another problem. And I think that the dollar savings that our constituents have enjoyed because of the energy efficiency standard, we want them to continue to enjoy those savings. But I think we can tailor the law so that the communities that really can't do the same things that the larger utilities can do have some relief and some certainty. And so I hope that we can work together on this as the bill moves forward.
Mr. Black, a question. First of all, any other questions for members? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Baker, I just kind of want to echo what Representative Hortman was saying. She actually said most of what I was going to say anyway. But I think that there's some good things in your bill. I will say that. I think there's some room for improvement, especially when it comes to the SIP program. But the one question that I did have that I didn't hear an answer on, because of who this bill directly affects, is where are the co-ops on this bill?
Representative Baker, or I guess Mr. Black, you're not a co-op. Representative Baker.
That's a great question, Mr. Chair and Representative Simonson. I think they're working through the issues of having a little different model than, say, the munis. The munis are a little bit more standalone. And we got most of the rural electric co-ops, they work with their generation power groups, you know, GRE and so on. So they have more of a shared model of energy savings. So what they're trying to do right now is actually look at this bill. They're actually not opposed to this at all. They just want to take a little bit more time, have the ability to talk to some of their rural co-ops independently to see if this is something they want to get behind. Right now, they don't have to do anything, and they're a part of this. They don't have to do anything different to do really what they're currently working with the commissioner now with their savings plans. Right now, they just want to spend more time talking to their co-ops, and probably with the limited time that we have here, they didn't have the time to kind of tee this up ahead of time. Initially, I got some very good response. This is a good bill. I think they will, after talking with more of their local units, they will be much more supportive publicly, but I think right now they're trying to work through those details. And there may be somebody here that wants to talk about that, maybe not, but I've had some excellent conversations with the co-ops. How about this?
Is there anyone representing the co-op who can testify on this bill? Okay. Representative Simpson, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly. So, Representative Baker, I would just encourage you as this moves forward to reach out to some of us because I think there's something here and that we could support, but we'd love to work with you on it.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know at the beginning of the testimony I heard about low-hanging fruit with some of the LED light bulbs and such, and I know they're, at least in my area, in Mountain Iron specifically, who we talked about, there was a pretty big push for fluorescent upgrades. I think there's, with our understanding of the mercury and different things, a big transition now to LED, of which I've done at my house with my wife over the last year. But I can assure you that there are plenty of low-hanging fruit left for people who went and got the fluorescents who could probably still love to take advantage of a local program to get a little rebate on a light bulb at a local store. So just encouraging words that I'd love to see some incentives for light bulbs for my constituents.
Mr. Black, question for you. The in your opinion, does this bill allow utilities, with the inclusion of the specifically paragraphs E and F, does it allow utilities the opportunity to reduce pollution, reduce consumption, to have more megawatts? I'm going to start using that term, more megawatts than current law at a lower price?
Mr. Chair, I would say yes, because if they can get going on the infrastructure projects, I think some of them are being put off because they just can't get the credit for them and they have to prioritize. And if they can't get the credit because they have to start so late in the year, when it's too late to buy the equipment at a volume discount or get the planning together, I think there probably would be. And I'm pretty confident that there would be.
Mr. Black, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, just to say that the co-ops and the municipals all together combined may be making 1.7%, but there are a lot of utilities, like I said, only one-third of the municipal utilities who are reporting, so really only about a quarter of the municipal utilities are able to make the 1.5% goal. And every year that they don't, they get a letter from the department that says, we reject your plan for next year because it doesn't say 1.5%. That's what we're trying to get at here, is just to not reduce the amount of savings, but get the goals to be commensurate with the potential of the utilities themselves.
I think reasonable concerns have been brought up today, and I think this is an example where if people bring corrective language forward, this could be an easily resolvable problem this year. So, Representative Baker, do you have any closing comments?
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair, because I know we're limited on time. Thank you, committee. I'm looking forward to getting some feedback from you. Send me an email. Let me see what you're thinking of. I've got some thoughts as well. We can make this better, and I'm looking forward to that. This is a moment in time, I think, that we can celebrate. SIP has really done a lot of good things. I don't want to see it go away, but I think it just needs to be managed properly. We have to trust our smallest utilities are doing everything they can in these communities, and I just want to support a good bill that everybody can get behind. I want this to be 100% approval from all of us on the House floor. So eventually when it gets there, I'd like to see that. So, Mr. Chair, with that, that'll be it.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Moran, if you want to start coming down with your testifiers, Representative Hortman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would encourage the municipal utilities to reach out to those of us to tell us what they're trying to accomplish and at least make the attempt to work with us.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion to have House File 2486 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Moran, welcome to the committee. Representative Mahoney, would you like to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move, to make sure I get the right bill number, House File 2440.
Representative Mahoney moves House File 2440 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Moran, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, thank you for allowing this bill to come before the committee. So real quickly, this legislation provides a grant to Ujamaa Place to expand their capacity to serve their target population of young, economically disadvantaged, homeless, and chemically dependent African-American men. By providing education, housing, chemical health, and employment support, Ujamaa is drastically reducing recidivism within the community they serve. The program works. There is 80% employment retention among participants, and the Wilder Research has evaluated the program and estimates a return on investment of at least 2-to-1. Ujamaa Place embraces young men who have experienced repeated cycles of failure and builds them into young black leaders. Mr. Chair and members, As a parent of a young man who has greatly helped this program, who has been greatly helped by this program, I can tell you the work they are doing is essential for our community, and it works. So from that, I will allow Otis Zanders, Ujamaa Place CEO, and Kandar Hittman, Ujamaa Place Program Manager, to testify.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Otis Zanders. I serve as the CEO of Ujamaa Place. Thank you. We'll be as brief as we can. We have a long story, but we will try to adhere to the time we have left. Very briefly, we are working on the first quarter of our 6 year of operation. For a little over 5 years, we've been providing transformational services for young men, primarily in the East Metro of the Twin Cities. We are commonly referred to as a social justice enterprise because of our holistic model that we do. If there's one word I'll leave you with, is that we stabilize the lives of young men that have a history of marginalization or just that just need a little lift in life. As hoped in front of you, documents that we've shown you, not only our key findings from our documented history of our report card that was done in 2013 by Wilder. Just to come in, note that every 2 years we'll be doing an update study. We are preparing work now to turn over to Wilder for the our ROI report for the year 2015. So we're very proud of our growth that we've been having. But basically, I'd like to know from our group that a lot of men that we work with come to us either homeless or in unstable housing. They're either unemployed or unemployable. They have a disconnection with their families and children. They come to us with some kind of histories of mental illness as well as chemical history as well. So what we have done in the time that we work with men by providing high context coaching with this holistic program is being able to stabilize their lives till they reached heights that was unimaginable in the beginning. But I will say that one of the things that we're doing now is putting a great disruption in poverty. The bigger return that we're doing right now is making sure that we have an employment. We are showing that the young men that come to us after our training, after our stabilization process, they are getting employment and they're retaining those employments. They are getting a GED, and a lot of them are going on to post-secondary work. And also we have measurable growth in their housing as well. We have quickly have turned into a program that the juvenile as well as the adult criminal justice system see as an adult sanction instead of a lot of being signed on to programs that would be up under the jurisdiction of government entities. We become a day reporting alternative sanction for the lower level offenders. But because of our credibility with those criminal justice entities, we also have contracts with them that we're being leveraged with that. So this bill that we have in front of you, we use that for leverage to keep our approach going. We've been very fortunate. Our funding right now has been primarily through the philanthropy community, individual donors. But we are poised to leverage this support with national foundation as well. So what we have is an organization that now that has proven that they are effective, this holistic programming in terms of what we're doing in the job market. And again, our return on this investment is that we think we're putting a tremendous interruption into the flow into the criminal justice system by providing stable housing, employment, connecting them with their families, and improving the education level. We have shown that our greatest return on investment that we can provide you as well as our supporters is that we are saving the state of Minnesota a tremendous amount of money through saving time going into the criminal justice system. With that brief introduction, I would like to hear from my program manager, Kandar Hittman, to just put a little meat on the bone. I just hope for time to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before you begin your testimony, Representative Moran, or to each of our testifiers, on line 1.10, the amount that may be expended for organizational capacity building is not filled in. Do you have a thought on what that should be, or is it something you wish to address later?
Mr. Chairman, we left it blank because the appropriation that we requested is for 100% funding for approximately 100 men in our growth. And that would include housing, employment, what have you. And we need to do a market search in terms of depending on the profile of the 100 men that we budgeted for, because some may not need housing or they may not need, they may come with the education in order. So that figure that we submitted for consideration is the total amount if we would add 100 new members to our enrollment.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Kedar Hickman. I am the program manager for Ujamaa Place, and I would like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members for letting us come before you and testify on behalf of the Ujamaa men and our organization, Ujamaa Place. Just in the interest of time, because we would really like to answer any questions that you have, I just want to add some volume around what our partnership with Wilder Research has been. From the very beginning, is we thought it was important to align ourselves and partner with a research organization that can help us with our evaluation, help us keep our data in line, and can help us tell our story about the services that we provide. While the research, in their process of working with Ujamaa Place, took a look locally, what organization is providing such a holistic wraparound service for a population within our state, citizens within our state who have been marginalized and who have been underserved in many cases. And what Wilder Research found was that there were no other organizations that has this kind of wraparound service when we speak to education, housing, chemical, behavioral wellness, connecting with families, and career and job development, that with such a wraparound services, there are no other organizations that do that. They opened up their scope regionally. Who does this work? They found that no one has done this work. And with an extensive network of partnerships that we have also. So I do want to, I would like to enter that into the thinking of your consideration. And then, we are dealing with real people, you know, with real men, and these men have children, and a big part of their stabilization reaches into the generations. When we speak to disparities, one of the ways that we can attack some of the disparities in our beloved state with our beloved citizens is by working with their parents and helping them to stabilize, which stabilizes the lives of young people also. And that is a big part of the work of Ujamaa Place also, and building communities. And how do we do that? We help to stabilize housing. We create pathways to prosperity through construction trade training that we do. One of our next endeavors is to build a pathway to prosperity and employment and career through information technology. Again, through stabilizing housing, through connecting with families, because we know that when we help our men to stabilize themselves, we are really stabilizing families, community, and ultimately we are adding to the value and to the wealth of our state in general. So with that, I thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. Is Chief Harrington here or not?
He was en route, but he hasn't made it yet, sir.
Okay, all right. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of questions. I will just make a statement on this rather than take time with questions. I have a connection with this particular group outside of the Capitol and their particular offices with three young men, and from where these three young men came from and what they did and where they are now, this is probably one of the best programs I've seen and heard in my 20 years here. I will say that without reservation. I've never really talked much about with those three young men about reconnecting with their children, but I know they have gotten rid of a pretty bad habit, and they have kept a job for the year that I've known them, and I am very proud of those three young men, and I don't say often that in committee that if we have the ability to put money into this program, this is one that we should really fund. It does do a good job, and does and provides services and transforms lives.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Scott.
Thank you. I was just getting a message from my LA. I had just a couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
under, I'm looking at your flow chart here.
Yes.
First of all, what is UJAMA? What does that translate for into English?
Yes. That's thank fair. You. Mr. Chairman, committee member. UJAMA is a Swahili word, which means connecting families and communities. We talk about individualized, but primarily in the layman terms, it would be called connecting families and communities.
Okay, wonderful. I like that. I like that name. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple questions on the bottom line of where it talks about foundational elements under empowerment and spirituality, and then under African American culture. If you could just briefly explain or maybe direct me, maybe all this information is on a website somewhere, but I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the spiritual development and then describe to me what value black ways and knowing and worldviews, what, if you could elaborate on that comment too a little bit, please.
Mr. Zanders.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee member. Yes, with those foundation elements, one thing about it is through the lens of Afrocentric teaching, what we try to do is understand through the African-American culture piece, if we don't have a little sense of pride in who their culture, not to be ashamed of themselves, what have you, we're finding out that the teaching to understand the shoulders they're standing on is a fundamental base that we try to instill with the participants of our program. So when we're talking about that lack of understanding of their culture history, that really becomes an incarceration without walls because they're locked up in their own mind, they're locked up in their own sense of growth, what have you. So our ability to try to unlock that through teaching, understanding, the shoulder they're standing on, about their heritage and culture. So again, that's a lot of the healing of the community. A lot of the young men that we get are trapped in their own zip code because of different things, of lifestyle issues, of differences, so they try to understand who they are, so we try to break that down. Empowerment and spirituality are huge fundamental pieces. We don't advertise ourselves as being a religious organization, but we think of that spiritual base. We understand that they understand the power that's higher. We are known that when we, before we eat, we say a prayer. We encourage people to attend religious institutions. We have been highly supported by the faith community. A large percentage of my referrals come from the faith community. So through that teaching, they again help us set that cognitive base. And that cognitive base comes with our empowerment and life skill development here. It's important that we trigger the cognitive thinking of our men to understand their growth pieces. So the empowerment to understanding where they've been and some of the life skills that need to take place. In empowerment is the ability to talk about building that is the moral compass, the discipline that needed to get a job, get paid on Fridays, and come back on Monday. Those little things that's missing out in a traditional setting. And that's because of the young men, a lot of men that we receive, is not coming from to say that. I've been on my own since I was 13, 14. Or a lot of the she would say that the male guidance is missing in their lives. So through the high context coaching, it's weaved into those pieces that we employ young African American men to talk about their culture and history of who we are now. And not just on the national level, but the local as well, to understand that the ground that we're sitting on now. But in that, we're sitting down there one-on-one talking about life skills as well as empowerment. Talk about this COG program to help them differentiate between right and wrong and the disciplines that needed to get on with life. And those foundation elements actually turns UJAMA into a verb, that we are UJAMA-ing our way out of poverty.
Members, I apologize that we went over our time, but I did think it was important that we heard from the people who are working in these areas directly. So thank you very much for your testimony today. Representative Moran, thank you for presenting this bill. With that, members, we're over our time, our apologies, but Representative Mahoney, I'm sorry, did you have a closing comment? No, okay.
Can I do a real quick closing comment,
Representative
please?
Moran.
And so I just want to close by saying when we look at employment and economic development and why it's a good thing to invest in this initiative, is that so often in this body we support trainings. But what this organization do is they give them soft trainings that they need that's often lacking to get them to prepare for training piece. So I know personally they are transforming young men's lives and really setting a strong foundation for communities and for our state.
Thank you, Representative Moran. With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 2440 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you to our testifiers.
Thank you.
Committee, thank you for your time.